Welcome to Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, and Las Cruces Community Radio, KTAL LP at 101.5 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, a local nonprofit working to protect the Gila watershed through advocacy, education, and restoration. On today's show, we're going to talk about the bird die-off that happened in September 2020 in New Mexico and other neighboring states. My guests today are Professor Martha Desmond from New Mexico State University's Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Ecology Department, and Jonathan Hayes, the Executive Director of Audubon Southwest, which covers New Mexico and Arizona. Welcome, Martha and John.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Donna.
Yeah, I'm really glad you could join us. This is a topic that's close to my heart because I'm a bird lover. So I wanted to talk to start today's show by talking about the bird die-off or the bird mortality event that happened in fall of 2020. Martha, can you please tell our listeners what happened, how many birds died approximately, and then we can get into the reasons behind this tragic event.
Absolutely. What I'm going to do is take us back to actually August of 2020. And Trish Cutler, who's a biologist at White Sands Missile Range, started reaching out to a group of folks across the state who are involved in avian conservation. And this group is the New Mexico Avian Conservation Partners. Both John and I are members of this group. And Trish was saying she was observing bird mortalities at White Sands Missile Range and asking if anyone else across the state was seeing this. And none of us were. And it wasn't a huge number of mortalities. It was just on a regular basis. They were picking up dead birds, something that they don't normally see. And she actually reached out to us multiple occasions in late August and then in early September. But again, no one else was seeing anything like this. Then in early September, September 8th through 10th, we experienced an extreme weather event across the state. And after this event, many people began to observe dead birds. And it took some time to understand the magnitude of this event. And so we weren't as prepared for it as we would have liked to have been. Many of us were enjoying the large number and diversity of birds in our region and in our yards. I sat on my porch on September 11th and counted 30 species of birds in my yard. I don't normally see that. And then we stories started pouring in from just all over the state. We were observing birds there were more mortalities on White Sands Missile Range. We were observing lethargic birds in many areas across southern New Mexico. In northern New Mexico at Soda Dam, birds were actually crawling into the hot springs and crawling into caverns in the ground and dying. Hundreds of violet green swallows were found dead at individual locations, mostly up in the north, but we also found them here in the southern part of the state. Swallows of mixed species down here in the south were crowding into barn swallow nests, sometimes a dozen of them in one nest and dying. And I got accounts from people all over the state of how they have this route that they'll usually drive and they hit so many birds that morning, something that they never do. And I walked out to my main street and picked up over a dozen dead birds in a 2-mile stretch. And there were a lot of mortalities that couldn't even be collected anymore. It was just mind-boggling to really witness this. And on the evening of September 11th, at my house, 2 western wood pewees roosted on my porch. Something I have never seen before. We're just on a wall on the back of the porch. And then the next morning when I got up, one was dead on the ground and the other was flying low to the ground. And so this was being observed all over the state. How many birds died? We honestly don't know. We just weren't prepared to deal with it. We know it was a lot.
And probably a lot more than we know about, because I'm sure a lot of birds died that people didn't report because they didn't know where to report or what to do about it.
Right. And then also when a little bird dies somewhere, a lot of times no one sees it. Or when they're hit by cars, and a lot of them were lethargic and flying out into the road to catch bugs and were being hit by cars or taken by predators, feral cats, people's pets, kestrels, roadrunners, you name it. These birds were extremely vulnerable.
So I think for bird lovers everywhere, and there's a lot of bird lovers, this mass mortality event was really heartbreaking. And so naturally, biologists and other people wanted to know why it happened. So to look for a reason or a combination of reasons, dead birds were examined in a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lab in Oregon. Martha, can you explain what necropsies are and then talk about what they showed as the reason for this mortality event?
Absolutely. So necropsies are basically, they're a postmortem examination, dissecting individuals to determine what was the cause of death. So it's an autopsy of these birds. And the birds from New Mexico were actually sent to two locations, the USGS National Wildlife Health Center and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Forensics Lab. So the forensics lab is in Ashland, Oregon, and the National Wildlife Health Center is in Madison, Wisconsin. And they both came back with the same reports. And basically, there was one thing in common for all mortalities, and that was these birds were in poor to severely emaciated body condition. They were starving. They were wasting their major flight muscles. So they were using their flight muscles, these muscles that carry them south for migration, just to survive. They had kidney failure, empty stomachs, and a small amount of blood in their intestines, which again is a sign of starvation. And they had no fat deposits. And these fat deposits, again, are the energy stores that they hold on to carry them south for migration. And yeah, it was heartbreaking. It really was heartbreaking.
So these are all birds that are migrating birds that migrate every fall. Can you tell our listeners what migration is like for these birds and talk about the toll that migration takes on them?
Absolutely. So migration is really an amazing feat, and it's a very dangerous time for birds. Birds migrate twice a year. So in the fall, they head south to areas that will support them over winter. And that's the adults and the young of the year that they brought off that year. And then in the spring, those that survive the fall migration and the overwinter period head back north again. Billions of birds move through the Western United States every year for migration. And most of these birds, the small passerines, especially that we're used to, migrate at night. And some people are really surprised to hear that. But at night, it's less turbulent. The air temperatures are cooler for the birds. And birds will travel at very high altitudes, many up to 10,000 feet, some quite a bit lower, some double that, quite a bit higher. And these birds can also travel amazing distances, thousands of miles or more. When they are migrating, again, it's a very dangerous time. They encounter harsh weather. They have to cross hostile terrain, deserts, and oceans. They encounter human disturbances and are vulnerable to predation, especially in unfamiliar areas where they stop to refuel. And so refuel, I mean, putting on more fat reserves to continue their trip. And why are they more vulnerable? One, because they're not familiar with those specific locations. And two, because they so urgently need to feed, they're not as vigilant as they normally are. And apparently this most recent time, they were also just in very poor condition, which made them extremely vulnerable. It's been estimated that birds are 6 times more likely to die on migration than what we call the stationary times of the year, the winter and the breeding season, even though they're much shorter time periods. Half of avian mortalities occur during migration. Something else that I think is really important is many folks are aware that when birds migrate, they collide with windows, they collide with radio and TV towers, even wind turbines. But fewer people are aware of the effects of light pollution, and that is bright lights attract and can confuse, that is disorient birds when they're migrating, especially during bad weather like the event we had in September. And what happens is the birds get drawn into these lights, they'll circle around the lights, they start calling profusely, and then they either collide with something or they drop to the ground exhausted from that event. So bright lights in an otherwise dark area, like in an otherwise dark desert, may actually have played a role in this mortality event. And that's something we're looking into, but we don't know the extent of that.
Yeah,
let me just add, Donna, that New Mexico is a particularly important area for migration, too. We serve as a sort of a bottleneck from both the Northwest and Northern states, as a lot of these birds are traveling down to Mexico and in Northern South America. And so we have kind of an abundance of migratory birds that are going through these long flights here in New Mexico.
Yeah, I do remember. Thanks for adding that, John. I do remember when I first heard that birds migrate at night, being really surprised by that information. And that was many years ago, but I thought, well, how do they see at night? So I'm really glad that you brought that up, because it was something that confused me a long time ago. I want to ask, what was different, or was there something different about 2020's fall migration? I mean, Martha, you did mention the weather event in September. I wasn't here, so I wasn't here during September, so I missed that. But I wonder if there was anything different about 2020's fall migration that caused this vulnerability in the birds. And also, I wonder if climate change played any role in this bird mortality event.
Well, I think everything's different about 2020, Donna.
Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And so during this large mortality event, we observed what you might refer to as the perfect storm. And that's a combination of events that came together and resulted in this large scale mortality. And those events included the ongoing drought across the Western United States, extreme fire across the Western United States, and extreme weather. And this is all actually being coined a new term in ecology, and it's disaster ecology. And this is what's going on here. And so fire may have displaced birds before they were ready to migrate. It may have caused them to change their migratory pathways. We don't know for sure now, but that's something that's being looked at. Drought conditions would have made food scarce. At stopover sites, when birds were stopping to refuel, they may have had a hard time finding those fuels that they needed. And then when that extreme weather came through, it made that food for the insectivores unavailable. It was gone. So birds in already poor condition all of a sudden didn't have resources to feed on. And that extreme weather brought in a strong cold low pressure system. It had freezing temperatures, rain and snow in many parts of the state, extremely high winds up to 70 miles an hour, and for over a 24-hour period. So these conditions together were lethal for a lot of these birds. And I think that weather event is what really put the icing on the cake. So yes, I would have to say, and this also happened at a time when millions of birds were in the air, were in transit across our area. So yeah, I would have to say that it's very apparent that climate change did play a role in this mortality event.
Okay. I'm wondering, we need to take a break in a minute, but before we do, I'm wondering if you can answer if a bird mortality event like this has happened in the past.
Yes, mortality events have happened in the past. They're not common, but they do occur, and they're usually associated with a single kind of short-term weather event, like a tornado or a snowstorm. But what we're seeing here today is different, because it's a combination of events coming together, and this extreme weather, which is resulting in a reduction in food, that's resulting in vulnerability to wildfires, and then also to very harsh conditions. And those factors together, I think, is something we have not seen happen.
Okay, well, thank you for that information. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back on Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU at 89.1 FM, and KTAL LP at 101.5 FM in Las Cruces. We'll continue our discussion about the bird mortality event in New Mexico in fall of 2020. Don't go away. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City and KTAL LP 101.5 FM in Las Cruces. I'm your host for today's show, Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I am here talking today with Dr. Martha Desmond of New Mexico State University and John Hayes of Audubon Southwest about the bird mortality event that occurred in fall of 2020. Right before the break, we were talking about the bird die-off or the mortality event of 2020. And I wanted to ask you, Martha, how widespread was this bird mortality? Did it extend beyond New Mexico?
Yes, Donna, it did extend beyond New Mexico. So it was very widespread across New Mexico. And then we also had reports into eastern Arizona, western Texas, south central Colorado was hit very hard. And I suspect that northern Mexico also saw a lot of mortalities.
So, I mean, 2020, as we said earlier, it was a very difficult year. And that's definitely an understatement. I know that when I began to hear about the birds dying, I was at my family's house in Colorado, and it really just seemed like this was just too much. You know, there were so many bad things going on, and that just seems just like I just couldn't handle anymore. And I know that there's a lot of bird lovers and other people felt the same way. And I understand that as a response to this bird mortality event, there was a New Mexico State University grad student, Allison Salas, who set up a website called Southwest Avian Mortality Project so that the public could report the dead birds that they were finding. Can you talk about this?
Sure. Right away, as soon as we realized the scale of this event or the potential scale, and it was already late, we were already late, we realized we needed to reach out and get reports, and we were debating how can we do this. So Allison put her skills to work, and she established a platform on what's known as the iNaturalist. And the iNaturalist is an app you can upload to your phone. And on the site, people were able to upload pictures and their observations of dead birds. And hundreds of people responded to the app across the West. And through this app, we were able to create a map of the extent of the event. And this is, it's an extremely valuable tool. So citizen science helped enormously with us being able to understand where else these observations of dead birds were taking place. And the nice thing about it too is it's going to help us prepare for the next time this happens. So, you know, we can think down the road, yeah, we're probably going to see this again. And next time we'll be ready to, you know, get that out right away. It's already in place and people can start to report and we can just start to gather more knowledge on this.
But it I was, think one, oh,
go ahead, John.
Excuse me. I was just going to say one of the more heartening things, one of the few nice things to see as a result of this, and there were few, was the outpouring of concern, support, reporting from the public, from citizen scientists. We started to get a ton of calls at Audubon Southwest. People wanted to do the right thing for the birds, but also just hearing about the story and wanting to help and wanting to join in efforts to conserve birds. And we even saw this story. I think both Martha and I were quoted in a news outlets from England to Indonesia that were driven by people's interest and concern for events like this. So while this is incredibly sad and troubling for us, it was nice to see the public concern.
The outpouring of concern from across the world was, John's right, was amazing. And so some of it came on the app and others just came through emails and phone calls. And some of them were people who just, what can I do to help? And other people like Christchurch, New Zealand, just calling to give their condolences. I have so many messages on my phone and in my email, it was impossible for me to deal with the emergency that was going on and respond to all of that. And it was heartbreaking and people felt it everywhere. It was really amazing.
Well, I'm glad that there was a silver lining because I just felt the heartbreak, you know, because I was there in Colorado, as I said, and I wasn't here to see it personally or to talk with anyone about it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can tell our listeners what species of birds were impacted by this mortality event. I mean, I know that when I looked at that list on iNaturalist, it seemed like warblers were particularly hard hit. Are they especially vulnerable during migration?
Any of the insectivores, when there's any type of cold snap, are extremely vulnerable. And these are the birds that feed on insects almost exclusively. The birds that are granivorous, that will feed on the seeds on the ground, they can still access that. But actually, we had both, you know, up in northern New Mexico, the mortalities were primarily insectivores. Here in the south, we had a large number of granivores that were mortalities as well. So over 30% of the mortalities that we observed were sparrows and other granivores. But I'll tell you, but warblers are extremely vulnerable. Swallows, violet green especially, were also very vulnerable to this event. And we documented over 50 species of birds in southern New Mexico alone. And these are both nocturnal and diurnal migrants. So some birds do migrate during the day. Your swallows, your insectivores migrate during the day. Your hummingbirds migrate during the day. Swallows were particularly vulnerable. Western wood pewees, a bird we don't often see down here, were abundant and were made up a large number of the mortalities. Wilson's warblers, Audubon's warblers, chipping sparrows, clay-colored sparrows, lark sparrows, yellow-headed blackbirds, and brown-headed cowbirds. Those were our dominant mortalities in this part of the state. Warblers were hard hit, as well as some of the other insectivores. And just to give you an idea of the diversity, we had a lot of different flycatchers: willow, olive-sided, lease, cordillian, vermilion, dusky, harmons, western kingbirds, loggerheaded shrikes, plumeous vireos, warbling vireos, northern water thrush, Townsend's warbler, western tanager, yellow warbler, orange crown warbler, McGivlerly's warblers, barn swallows, cliff swallows, hermit thrushes, blue grosbeaks, lozzleeyed buntings, black-headed grosbeaks, indigo buntings, lark buntings, savannah sparrows, green-tailed towhees, the list goes on. So there was a large and diverse group of birds that were impacted by this.
That's really heartbreaking. Yeah. I just feel like we keep using that same word over and over again because it's so appropriate. I just want to clarify one thing. You used a word that I think some of our listeners might not be familiar with, a granivore. Can you explain what that is?
So granivores are your birds that feed on seeds, your seed eaters. And a lot of our sparrows, our ground feeding birds, feed on seeds. But, and you have to say, okay, in a cold snap, those seeds are still going to be available. Whereas with your insects, they're not going to be as available. However, you have to remember conditions this year have been extremely dry, which means seed production is low. And so these birds are really struggling as well.
Right. And our insect populations have been plummeting in the last few years.
Absolutely.
So that's been, you know, for insectivores, that's very dangerous, too. So, yes. Martha, you read a long and heartbreaking list of all the birds that succumbed last fall. A lot of these birds were small or kind of medium sized birds. But I also saw on the list a couple of large birds, such as barn owls and great horned owls. And I just thought that they would have greater fat reserves that they could call upon during migration. Do you have any ideas about why they also died?
Sure. I think, well, one is there are some birds that are going to die from unrelated reasons during this event. Okay. And the vast majority of the mortalities we observed were migratory birds, not resident birds like the great horned owl. But I also got some American coots came in, a cattle egret came in. But some of these are birds that maybe just died otherwise, but it wasn't for the same reasons that these large number of passerines died. But also, you know, individuals and maybe individuals that were weak and they were pushed over the edge by this by the stressful conditions.
Okay, so thanks for clarifying that. I remember when I saw the owls on the list that I was surprised because I thought, do they migrate? So no, they don't, but they were on the list perhaps for other similar reasons.
Sure, but also up north, there were a large number of flammulated owls died. And so this is a smaller owl, but it's an insectivorous, primarily insectivorous owl. And so when they're up in those northern areas and that storm hit, the food supply for those birds was just completely cut off.
Okay. Yeah. It was such an extremely dry year that even for birds who are resident birds and don't migrate, there wasn't much food. And I wanted to go back to a question that I had earlier, and then the conversation moved on. Are there still any studies or reports coming in, or do we kind of have the last word on what we think happened last fall?
We know these birds starved, but there are studies ongoing. Absolutely. So we know what happened, but we want to know what were the events that led up to this and what were the different conditions and the different things that may have caused it. So there are a number of different studies that are ongoing right now, even still looking at the effects of forest fire and did it change the migratory pathway of these birds or did it change the timing of birds? They may have been forced to leave early. And there still may be some, there was some indication that smoke inhalation was a problem, but not for a large number of them. So maybe there were issues with different groups of birds. We're also working with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the Genoscape Lab out of the University of California, Los Angeles, to try to determine other factors like the effects of light pollution and also the effect, what were the migratory routes that some of these birds were taking? Where did they come from? So a good example for that is the Wilson's Warbler, because the Wilson's Warbler, the whole genome of the bird has been mapped, so they can actually look at individuals and say what part of the breeding range they came from. And based on that information, we can kind of track where they started and where they moved through.
Oh, that's really fascinating.
And other things to come out of this are maybe there are certain species that are particularly vulnerable to these types of events. And so those are other things we want to look at and think about.
Okay, well, we need to take a short break, but we will be right back on Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM, and KTAL LP Las Cruces Community Radio at 101.5 FM. And we're going to continue to talk about the status of birds, so please stay with us. Welcome to the second half of Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City and KTAL LP 101.5 FM in Las Cruces. I'm your host for today's show, Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I am talking with Dr. Martha Desmond of New Mexico State University and Jonathan Hayes of Audubon Southwest about the status of birds in New Mexico and Arizona. In the first half of the show, we talked about the tragic bird mortality event that happened in fall of 2020. But even before this mortality event, this bird die-off, birds were in serious trouble in New Mexico. So I want to spend the rest of the show talking about the status of birds in our state and in Arizona and nationally. John, can you tell our listeners some of the threats to birds?
Yeah, sure, Donna. So some of your listeners might remember or might have seen about a year ago, there was a report released by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and a number of other partners that reported a 3 billion birds lost in the last half century. And so what they were really showing there was data from the Breeding Bird Survey, which is a survey that's done every spring by professional bird counters. And what they found is throughout North America, by and large, about half of the bird, we've seen the bird population decline by about half in that time. And that's happened differently in different places, different habitat types, different regions, different geographies. But New Mexico has absolutely felt the effects of some of that. And some of that's because some of the landscapes that we have here are some of those that are most heavily impacted by human activity and by changes to the habitat that these birds rely on. And so, you know, there's a lot of issues out there that birds face, whether it's, chemicals and pesticides on the landscape, direct mortality from things like house cats or collisions with man-made structures that wouldn't normally be there and birds aren't evolved to expect. But really, the number one driver of bird decline has been loss of habitat, and that's across habitat types, across geographies, across continents, really. And it affects different groups of birds in different ways, and these different habitat types have been affected in different ways. And so when you think of something like our grasslands in eastern New Mexico in particular, you have a big area of short grass prairie. We've seen changes to that habitat, even if it's not, a new building or a city being, expanding. We've seen small changes that have resulted partly because we've removed fire as a natural process on the landscape, and also change from grazing bison, which were intermittent seasonal grazers, to a permanent grazing presence in cattle. We really rely on grasslands in particular to provide the food, fiber, and fuel to keep this country running. And one of the costs of that has been the habitat that it provides. But we haven't, those losses haven't been limited to grasslands. Woodlands in particular, in New Mexico, one of the woodland types that we're most concerned about is pinyon juniper habitat, sort of a transition zone from some of the lower elevation uplands to sort of mountainous pine forest. That PJ habitat's one that's really pretty common in New Mexico, and a lot of people sort of disregard it. You can just kind of drive through and not really notice it, but it's really an important habitat for birds like pinyon jay, juniper titmouse, gray vireo, some of these birds that really need the forage that provides. The pinyon pine in particular provides a great mast crop for birds to live off. And we've seen the effects of bark beetle, drought, catastrophic wildfire, all on that system as well. And so we're losing birds associated with that. And then our rivers in particular in the Southwest, because they concentrate a number of different types of birds and other wildlife in areas where there's abundant vegetation and greenery and productivity, we see they play an outsized role in supporting biodiversity in these states. And quite honestly, a lot of our southwestern rivers have been run dry by our needs and our activity. You know, the Gila River is a great example of an area where an effort was actually undertaken to prevent a diversion that would have drained parts of the river. So while we avoided the diversion on the Gila River, other rivers in the Southwest haven't fared so well, and we continue to see alterations of the natural flooding and runoff patterns because of climate change, but also because of human use. And so the birds that depend on those systems have been heavily impacted, along with many of the others.
Yes, I'm glad that you mentioned the Gila River. That yes, we have had a victory on that, keeping that from being diverted, but it's a problem all over. So, and you also mentioned, John, the pinyon juniper forest, the PJ, that you're very concerned about. And I know that I have read some reports about the impacts that we expect to see from climate change in the future, and that perhaps those pinyon juniper forests are on their way out, which is surprising because I think of them as so extensive and kind of a lower elevation forest. And so I wonder if you can talk about if climate change is a factor in declining bird populations and how it's impacting birds.
I think the pinyon juniper habitat is actually a great example of that and how climate change is driving changes on the landscape. And so quite a few of the drivers of pinyon juniper habitat loss, or at least reduction in the quality or suitability of that habitat, can be directly linked to a change in climate. So one of the things we're seeing is increased amount of bark beetle kill in northern New Mexico and other places throughout the Intermountain West. Those beetle numbers and pests like them are regulated by really cold winters that can knock them back and not keep the populations at bay. When you have milder winters, you have more of that beetle killing. So that's something we've seen across the Rocky Mountains the last couple of decades. We also see increased incidence of drought, which can cause direct mortality. Even something as tough as a juniper that we have out here in our foothills can be killed by enough years or enough extreme drought in any given year. And so we've seen more of that in northern New Mexico. And then both of those things contribute to increased incidence of catastrophic wildfires. And so when you have more standing dead trees, maybe as a result of beetle kill, you have increased incidence of drought, so you have drier fuel moistures. It's just asking for a catastrophic wildfire to rip through these areas, much like the one we saw up near Los Alamos in 2011, the Los Conchas fire that took a ton of pinyon juniper habitat out and took homes away from those birds that depend on it. So yeah, PJ is a great example of habitat loss to climate. I mean, not a great one, it's kind of a sad one, but there's a lot of other systems that are impacted in different ways too. you know, more high altitude mountain forests, you know, as climate change drives changing weather conditions at different elevations, we see a sort of upward march of these different vegetation types, these different vegetation bands. Eventually, they get up to the top of the mountain and they have nowhere to go. And so those species that rely on those high up mountain environments are suffering an outsized impact of climate change as well. A bird like brown-capped rosy finch may not be able to breed and spend time in northern New Mexico over the summer as they used to, because some of the persistent snow patches where they forage up in the mountains are no longer there as a result of a milder winter and a warmer summer. And so the impacts are different in different systems and for different birds, but they're pretty consistent across all habitat types, that there's some level of impact and change that we're seeing.
So can you talk about some of the birds that are the most imperiled in our state? So I'm talking here about the birds that are federally listed as threatened or endangered.
Yeah, so we have a few listed species here in New Mexico. We also have quite a few birds that aren't listed that are declining as well. But the officially listed birds, the southwestern willow flycatcher and the yellow-billed cuckoo, both live primarily in riparian forests. And so the changes to the rivers that we were talking about earlier have greatly impacted them over the last century. And then there's a bird that's a candidate species for listing that was actually listed as threatened, then taken off as a result of some legal battles. But the lesser prairie chicken out in eastern New Mexico lives in our grasslands and rangelands, and that bird's declining significantly as well. But we see declines in species pretty consistently and pretty disturbingly, even those that aren't part of the list of threatened or endangered in the state. So a bird like Ben Dyer's thrasher, one that not a lot of people see, but actually lives down in Martha's World and in southern New Mexico, those birds have declined by 86% in the last 50 years or so. It's one of the fastest declining bird species in North America. And we've got others. You know, our long spurs are another grassland obligate species, both the now called the thick bill, formerly the McCowns, but also the chestnut collared, are two of the species that are declining fastest in North America. And they rely on the wintering grounds in the southeastern and southern parts of New Mexico to provide them that wintering habitat. Those birds have declined by 85-86% over the last 50 years as well. And so we're seeing these declines across the board, and we're losing birds, even ones that haven't quite made it to the listing stage yet from the Endangered Species Act. So it's pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in preparation for this show, I was looking at the Audubon website, and I saw that in addition to the species that are federally listed as threatened or endangered, there's also Audubon also has these lists of high, moderate, and low vulnerability species, and then another list that is stable species. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so you're referring to a report that Audubon released last year, our Survival by Degrees report, that really is documenting the impacts across North America of climate change at the population level of a lot of these species. And we know with climate change, there's going to be winners and losers. We can actually see areas where habitat's going to expand because you know, the habitat's more conducive to the conditions that climate change will bring. Or we'll see a northward march of habitat conditions because we're seeing changes in temperature and climate move north. And so on the northern end of that, you could see an expansion of a habitat into an area where it wouldn't already be. Whereas at the southern end of that, maybe we're losing that habitat, say grassland becoming more arid and turning into desert. So there's going to be winners and losers in this. Some populations are likely to remain stable. Some might even benefit, although they're very few. But by and large, we're seeing significant declines. And that decline, that level of decline can vary depending on how sensitive the habitats are to climate change. And so our report documented species that were highly vulnerable, that are likely to lose enough habitat in the next century under, say, a 3-degree warming scenario where we could actually put that population at risk of extinction. There's species that are a little less vulnerable, and there's species that we're saying that that might not see those effects but for various reasons. So, yeah, the impacts are significant, but they're not going to be felt equally across all species.
Right. I noticed when I was looking at that list, that the stable list of species, that even the birds that were on the stable list seemed vulnerable to me, because I clicked on a few of them and it would say that they could be impacted by rising sea levels. And okay, if you're in New Mexico, that might not matter so much. But if you're on the coasts, even those stable birds might not be quite so stable. Can you talk about just maybe an example of one or two of these birds that are that aren't faring so well?
Sure. So, the water birds and the shore birds are a great example of the differential impact we're going to see in some places as opposed to others. There's some places where a bird might be doing just fine, but that same bird, those same populations can be hurting elsewhere. And so that brown-capped rosy finch is a great example of that. There's places where there's going to be plenty of habitat in the Rocky Mountains to provide that overwinter or that overbreeding season foraging ground and those persistent snow fields. But in places in the southern extent, we're going to lose that more likely. And so we're seeing those changes. There's also species that have adapted to human life being a persistent presence on the landscape as well. So birds like ravens and crows, who are pretty smart, pretty opportunistic, and have actually made the best of human beings in their habitat, actually tend to do pretty well. Even a bird like the New Mexico state bird, the roadrunner, tends to look like it's going to do pretty good in a changing climate by and large, because they've adapted pretty well to life around people and tend to do pretty okay. And so, a lot of it depends on sort of how sensitive that species is, how particular, how specific that species is to a given habitat type or condition, and then just how opportunistic their behaviors are and how adaptable they can be to changing conditions.
Okay, well, thank you for that, John. We need to take a break. We'll be right back on Earth Matters on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM, and Las Cruces Community Radio, KTAL LP at 101.5 FM in Las Cruces. And we're going to continue talking about the status of birds in our state and even regionally. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Earth Matters on KURU 89.1 FM in Silver City and KTAL LP 101.5 FM in Las Cruces. I'm your host for today's show, Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I am talking with John Hayes of Audubon Southwest and with Dr. Martha Desmond of New Mexico State University about the status of birds. Before the break, John, we were talking about an Audubon report called Survival by Degrees, and this is a recent study of about 600 species of birds that talks about how the birds will fare under different global warming scenarios. Can you talk about the primary findings of this study?
Yeah, gladly. And so this is one place where there's a bit of, I think, hopefulness that we should all feel in that our analysis showed that under a 3-degree warming scenario, and I'll speak specifically to New Mexico for a second, under a 3-degree warming scenario, we'd see 57 species as highly vulnerable to extinction by the end of the century. But if we keep that to only a 2-degree warming, which is not necessarily the track we're on now, but would take some major changes in investments nationally. But if we were able to do that, we would only see 15 of those species in New Mexico being highly vulnerable to extinction. So that difference between 57 to 15 species being vulnerable to extinction under a 3-degree versus a 2-degree warming scenario is something we saw consistently throughout North America. And so the take home is that we all do have agency. This isn't inevitable, and the declines aren't inevitable. We can do things to prevent this, and we just need to act now and act with strength and commitment.
Thank you for that. And we'll talk a little bit later in a couple of minutes about some other things that people can do as individuals to help birds. But before we get to that, Martha, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation and ask you what some of your biggest concerns about New Mexico's birds are.
Well, many of these are things that John has actually touched on, but climate change, of course, is a big one. And many birds in New Mexico reach the southern extent of their range in parts of the state. And that, of course, makes them extremely vulnerable to climate change. Habitat loss, but also the degradation and the fragmentation of habitat. These are things that could be due to energy development in the state and also the desertification of our landscape. So the encroachment of native shrubs into areas that were historically grasslands or had much lower densities of shrubs. It's changed the ecosystem, and it's not good for the birds that are associated with those systems. And then also, as John mentioned, the changes to ecological processes, fire, grazing, flooding, that are important and essential for the maintenance of our native ecosystems that these birds are adapted to. So I think those are all extremely important.
Yes, I would agree with that. John, I mean, Martha covered a lot. Did you have anything to add to that about your concerns about New Mexico and Arizona's birds?
No, not particular. It's a good list. And I think the bird conservation community in a lot of way has aligned to recognize the same challenges, and we all focus in the same areas. I think that it can't be expressed enough how climate change can, you know, have this overarching existential threat to birds in these populations. While we can, you know, work locally to do everything we can to restore habitat, to provide the conditions they need, if we see a significant shifts, and quite frankly, the southwestern states are front and center, the front lines of climate change, and we're seeing threats, whether it's increased fire, drought, temperatures, catastrophic storms, big thunderstorms like the one we saw that caused the mortality event. Those things are really going to be accelerated in the Southwest more than most other parts of America. And so climate change for me is right at the top of that list, and we're at ground zero down here for it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point to make. I mean, some people just think that climate change means raising average temperatures, but it also means more extreme weather events, more severe storms. And that's, I guess, one of the things that we saw in September with the bird mortality event that we talked about at the beginning of the show. So, John, I want to turn to a couple of more practical things that more hopeful than some of the things we've been talking about. Can you talk about some of the annual bird counts that Audubon participates in? And then I'm also wondering if any of these events got canceled last year or were impacted by the pandemic.
So there's absolutely ways that people can get involved counting birds, even under the pandemic conditions. We've moved most our protocols to being COVID safe. And so there's a lot of opportunities, and getting outdoors, in small groups or alone, distance from people, is actually a great way to spend, COVID time, for sure. There's actually some opportunities for folks to participate in bird counts coming up. In February, in a couple of weeks, the 12th through the 15th, is the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is when birders from all over the world actually document what birds they see in their yards and on their feeders. And so you can do that in February. In May, there's what we call the Global Big Days, when we encourage birders all over the world to go out and go to their favorite birding destinations or try to cover some ground and count as many species of birds as they can. And then we do the Christmas bird count season, which is a study that's been around for a long time, where we ask folks, volunteers, to go out around Christmas to go count birds. It's something that Audubon started maybe close to 100 years ago, and it's been going strong since. And it's one of the best sources of data for wintering bird populations and abundance. All of those that I just listed are things that volunteers can do. And a great way to get involved in that is to join your local Audubon chapter. So in southern New Mexico in particular, there's a chapter there in Las Cruces, the Mesilla Valley Audubon Society. And in Silver City, there's the Southwest New Mexico Audubon Society. And they do regular trips, but also get involved in some of these bird hunts. So they're a great place to start.
I think those are really great examples of citizen science. And it seems like Audubon has been doing citizen science, even if it wasn't called that, for a really long time. Like you said, the Christmas bird count's about almost 100 years old. So we only have a few minutes left in the show, and I want to make sure that you both have an opportunity to talk about what are the ways that people can help birds? So we've talked about climate change, and a lot of that is kind of policy and government driven. But what are some of the recommendations that you both have for listeners of things they can do as individuals to help birds?
I think something that's really important is people can plant native vegetation. They can plant gardens that encourage insects and pollinators, berry producing shrubs, so that they create a natural food source for birds that are using their areas. That's incredibly important.
Yeah, keeping cats indoors is a big one. Feral house cats can be a major driver of bird mortality. It's something to be concerned about. On the note about native vegetation, the Audubon Society actually hosts a Plants for Birds website. And so if you want to go Google just Plants for Birds, you can type in your zip code and your email address, and you will get sent a list of native plant species that you can use either in your backyard or a potted plant or a garden, or if you own bigger acreage out on the land and you manage for these species and plant them, and they can help birds. So yeah, so checking out our Plants for Birds website. And then I would also encourage folks, if you're looking at the Audubon Society webpage, or if you go to Audubon New Mexico or Audubon Arizona, I would encourage you to sign up for our Audubon Southwest newsletter, which provides information and updates, stories about bird conservation in the Southwest. But most importantly, by signing up for that newsletter, you're signing up for action alerts for us. And those are when we need our membership to speak up, whether it's to an elected official, an agency, through comment on a project, or in the roundhouse in the legislative session each year. And so we're really active right now in the roundhouse, and we're actually sending to members that are in districts of influential committee members, we're sending action alerts to say how you can speak up on a given bill to take action and help. A good example of this is there's actually a bill being considered right now that would ban neonicotinoid pesticides use in New Mexico, with a few exceptions, but by and large would remove that chemical that's been deadly to insect populations and has other environmental effects across North America. So if you sign up for our action alerts, we'll tell you when there's a key vote, when there's a hearing, when it makes sense for you to call your state representative and tell them we support this bill. So keep posted with us and allow us to help you raise your voice to the powers that be.
I'm really glad you brought that point up, since we're kind of a couple of weeks into the New Mexico legislative session right now. And I know I'm getting action alerts all the time about bills, and they might not be specifically about birds, but they're about habitat, which, of course, is the backbone of bird, you know, how birds are going to fare. And I'm glad that you also brought up the native plants. So, because I'm a big proponent of planting native plants. And you can also go to the Native Plant Society of New Mexico website and get information about some plants that would be good for you to plant. In addition to helping birds, of course, they're also going to lower your water bill, because they're plants that are native to this area and don't use as much water. So it's kind of a win-win for everybody. And John, I want to also ask you, what if people want to learn more about the status of birds in New Mexico and Arizona, what recommendations do you have for them?
Well, I'm always plugging our website, so come join our newsletter and come check out the Audubon Southwest website. But I would say visit New Mexico Avian Conservation Partners, as Martha mentioned it earlier, is a group that we're both a part of that has actually lists of the species that are most vulnerable or of conservation concern for us. And not just looking at their population trends, but also the amount that New Mexico's, of their habitat that New Mexico is responsible for providing. And so a bird like Ben Dyer's thrasher might not be at the top of every list, but because New Mexico plays an outsized role in providing habitat for it, it's at the top of our list. So go to that New Mexico Avian Conservation Partners website. And then there's a variety of other large national bird conservation partnerships, like the Partners in Flight, NABCE, as we call it, the North American Bird Conservation Initiative, a number of these different web resources that you can look at to see what the whole scope of bird conservation looks like in the U.S. and in North America, and to learn about the particular birds in your area and the causes of decline and what you can do about it.
And I have just one last question for you about what people can do as individuals to kind of put you on the spot here. What about birds flying into windows? Do you have any advice for our listeners on that topic?
Absolutely. There are guidelines that Audubon's made available for large-scale builders and developers to actually build structures that are less conducive to bird strikes. But at your own home, I've got them on my windows. If you've got big, large windows, putting small stickers, and there's a lot of different ways to do it, and there's products you can buy out there right now, but you put stickers on your windows to make sure that the birds see that glass isn't either the sky that's reflected in it or a cave that they can fly freely to. They need to see that it's a piece of glass and something they should avoid. So absolutely do that. We encourage folks to do that, please.
Great. So we just have 1 minute left in the show. Martha, did you have anything to add to that about?
No, I guess I'll say I lived in a house where I did have window kills. And what I did also was I put plastic netting that I just hung down. And so the birds would hit that netting. They wouldn't get caught in it, but they'd hit that first before they hit the window. And that really reduced the mortalities.
Okay, well, those are both great suggestions. Thank you for that. So we have come to the end of our show, and I want to thank my guest, Professor Martha Desmond of New Mexico State University's Fish, Wildlife, and Conservation Ecology Department, and Jonathan Hayes, the Executive Director of Audubon Southwest, which covers New Mexico and Arizona. I'd like to thank our audio engineers, Marcus Hansen of Gila Members Community Radio and Michael Allen of Las Cruces Community Radio, and also the boards of both of these stations for keeping everything running during really challenging times. Also, many thanks to you, our listeners, for supporting the station and tuning into this week's program. I'm Donna Stevens of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM, and Las Cruces Community Radio, KTAL LP 101.5 FM. Please be well and safe out there for your sake and for others. This is what community radio looks like.